eyes of the world, the eyes of the populations of the world are on you, and we have your numbers.
That lingering sense of fleas remains, and we'll see what comes next.
We need to make sure that what sits there on a piece of paper is actually going to turn into tangible, actionable projects on the ground that are going to make a difference to people's lives.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
Good afternoon, I'm Ewan Potts.
Well, Operation Save Big Dog is underway. Whether or not you believe anyone in the government actually called it that, Boris Johnson survived the weekend, though, with a message that he will clean up Downing Street's drinking culture. The Sunday Times says that the government is planning a series of feel-good announcements to win back public support, while some senior civil servants may be sacked.
But the Prime Minister is walking a fine line. The Times reckons that almost three dozen Tory MPs support a no-confidence vote. Now, that's some way short of the 54 needed to trigger a leadership contest. Meanwhile, The Telegraph reports that Johnson has been questioned by civil servant Sue Gray, whose investigation into Downing Street parties is keenly awaited. Education Secretary Nadine Zahawi told Sky that we shouldn't yet jump to conclusions.
Let's wait for the investigation. I think it's only right. You know, remember, you know, our British values are all about, you know, fairness, and you don't condemn an individual before having all the facts before you.
So that was Nadeem Zahawi. Well, what are these feel-good measures? Well, reported by The Times, the possibility of an end to all Plan B coronavirus restrictions on the 26th of January, perhaps including scrapping tests for vaccinated travellers on their return to the UK. For now, the rules around isolation have also changed. People who catch COVID-19 in England now only need to isolate for 5 days instead of seven if they test negative on two consecutive days, so day five and day six.
Well, let's bring in our guest today, Steve McCabe, Labour MP for Birmingham Selly Oak. Thank you so much for joining us on the programme again, Steve. Now, the government has put in place lots of, or they're proposing lots of attractive policies, more money for the NHS, perhaps lifting COVID restrictions at the end of the month. Do you think the government is going to regain the initiative and move on from their troubles last week?
Well, it's possible, but I think they've got a bit of an uphill struggle. I mean, you know, the problem when confidence is damaged is that every feel-good announcement then raises an expectation, and if it turns out to be an announcement that you can't deliver on, it doesn't actually do you much good.
Do you think that Boris Johnson should resign?
Well, I mean, I think that's up to him, and I think it's up to some Tory members of Parliament. I think he's damaged.
Isn't the danger for Labour, if Boris Johnson does go, and of course many people in your party have been calling on him to go, isn't the danger is that the Tories then put in place a fresh face, somebody who's not tainted by all these scandals? They've done this many times in the past before, and then you're faced with Rishi Sunak or Liz Truss or somebody rather less unpopular than Boris Johnson.
Yes, I mean, we have a programme here, I think you get in the States as well, called Doctor Who, where the central character keeps regenerating. I mean, I suppose they might try and pull that trick again. The only question is, I wonder if in politics there's a limit to how many times you can get away with it. I mean, the problem at the moment is that Boris Johnson has damaged trust in the government. And, you know, I mean, people like Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak, they are backing the man. So to get rid of him and replace him with one of them, I'm not sure it will work quite as easily this time.
Yeah, I've seen that line reported in a few places, the concerns around the hit to democracy in and of itself from kind of lockdown rule breaking. But look, if Keir Starmer can have a drink with colleagues, as he's been pictured in the Daily Mail as doing, why not the Tories?
Well, I think the difference is that, as I understand it, he was absolutely genuinely working and popped into the kitchen for a sandwich. I don't think he was sending out invitations asking people to bring their own booze and organising industrial-scale parties. And, of course, he didn't bring the regulations into force that were being broken. I think, you know, I mean, I think this is a classic. It's not a surprise, is it? If one political figure is under attack, it's not surprising that supporters will go out and try to find something to level the score. But I don't think anybody in their right mind would say this is a comparison.
Talking on the COVID issue, this looks like we're going to be cutting the self-isolation from 7 to 5 days. That comes in today, in fact. Do you think that is a welcome step? Or do you worry that cutting it to 5 days is a little bit premature?
Well, I hope it's the right decision. I really hope it's the right decision. And I think we are actually reaching a point where tolerance of the COVID restrictions is about exhausted. So I hope it's right. But, of course, our hospitals and ambulance service are still under enormous pressure. And the whole idea of restrictions and lockdowns was to stop them collapsing. So, you know, like everyone else, I guess, I hope that this is the right decision. But I think the jury's out.
What about the idea of ending testing for people who are returning if they're double jabbed, i.e. allowing a bit more freedom of travel? And again, it would be a sweetener in the sense that it would happen perhaps, according to Grant Shapps or the Times reporting about Grant Shapps, that it would happen in time for the February half term. I mean, should that be dropped so swiftly?
Well, I mean, I can see why that actually might appeal to people. As I say, I think the tolerance of the restrictions, people may well be a bit exhausted by them. But, you know, I mean, these restrictions, when they were brought in because we were told they were designed to stop the spread of COVID and the different variants of COVID. And although it's turned out to perhaps not be as lethal as we feared, the speed of the spread of the Omicron variant was astonishing. I suppose the risk here is that if we suddenly drop things that we were told were absolutely essential just 4 or 5 weeks ago, it could backfire horrendously. And, you know, I don't think anybody wants that, but I think it is an example of the government gambling, and I think it's an example of a gamble being taken because they're in trouble.
You voted in favour of the Plan B restrictions. The vaccine passports only passed because of Labour votes. Do you think it's time to ditch the vaccine passports now, or do you want to see them stay in place for longer?
Well, I was very much in favour of the lateral flow test. I remain a trifle skeptical about vaccine passports myself. Look, I'm in favour of vaccines. I think vaccines are probably the best way of controlling this. I would like to hear the explanation that says we no longer worry about people meeting in big numbers in mass venues. If we're ditching it, fine, but I'd like to hear what the explanation is. I mean, you know, this is all about public confidence. And if you're telling people one thing one day and the exact opposite the next, it's hardly surprising that confidence becomes pretty stretched.
Well, perhaps the public also have other things to concern themselves now with. I mean, after 18 months, 2 years of the pandemic, it's household finances being squeezed that is worrying a lot of people. The increase in energy bills hasn't happened yet, but it's coming down the line and inflation is already going up. What's the solution to the energy crisis as far as Labour are concerned? Is it just cut VAT and cut the green energy taxes in order to sort of help households?
No, that's a short-term measure. And of course, that's the measure we were promised by Boris Johnson if we left the European Union. That's what he said he would do. So we are simply calling on him to honour that promise as a short-term measure to help families against the rising cost of energy bills. The long-term issue is to have a much clearer energy plan, a much clearer transition plan for transition to green fuels, and a much better gas management programme for the time being. All of that, perhaps because of COVID, I don't know, but all of that seems to be absent from government thinking at the moment.
That's all longer-term stuff, though, isn't it? But what needs to be done in the next few months to give people some relief from rising bills?
I think cutting VAT is the obvious thing. It's a fair measure. It means that it goes to everyone. Everyone has to pay energy bills. It's an across-the-board measure. It is an outstanding Brexit promise. So that, you know, that's something that should be done.
Is that the biggest concern that your constituents have now, then? Is it about their financial squeeze rather than just COVID?
Well, I think people are weary of COVID. I think you're right about that. And so other things are beginning to surface. Absolutely, the cost of living. It's not just energy. I mean, I think people are worried about rising food prices. I think they're worried about... it's energy, obviously, but fuel for their car as well as gas and electricity for their homes. And I think there is a continuing anxiety, a growing anxiety about crime, lack of police, house burglaries, car burglaries, car theft. I think crime and the cost of living are the things that are really beginning to rise up the political agenda in this country.
We're joined by Bloomberg's James Woolcock. Now, James, the Times reckons that there are 30-odd letters have gone into the 1922 committee looking for a leadership contest. Well, we don't really know that for sure. Publicly, there are far fewer than that. But just talk us through the what Boris Johnson needs to survive over the coming weeks.
I think it's such an interesting question, like sort of survival, because I think they break down to two parts. Can he sort of limp on, sort of wounded and sort of weakened with sort of his power base sort of fractured? Because the problem the Tory party faces, can they replace him and who can they replace him with? And that's, I think, what's leading to a lot of reluctance from Tory MPs. They're sort of saying, like, you know, is Sunak ready? I think Sunak and Truss and other sort of front runners in the cabinet are thinking, do we want to look like we're stabbing another leader in the back? And that's holding them back. But we're seeing, as with stuff like the BBC and other announcements this week, is Johnson trying to sort of get his base back on side with a lot of, sort of far-right accusations? A lot rests on the Sue Gray report, this sort of civil servant who is seen as very independent-minded. Keir Starmer was on LBC this morning. He said he's worked with her and he thinks she's a force to be reckoned with. But, like, can she release a report that sets out the facts that in some way exonerates Johnson, or will she throw the book at him and sort of set it back further? So there's that side of it, and kind of, can Johnson be replaced? But on the other side, there's this kind of, will he be able to kind of govern in the way that he would like, even if he can survive this scandal?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and the question of whether or not he even will be weakened or not, because one cannot rule out with a prime minister like Boris Johnson that he can revive his polling numbers, although they've sunk pretty low.
They've sunk pretty low, and I think what is really interesting now is it always has been scandals don't touch Boris Johnson. He can shrug off anything. I mean, I remember when he prorogued Parliament, we were outside the Supreme Court, and everyone was saying that would be the final week of the Boris Johnson premiership. I'm going to be careful around saying it again now. But there does seem to be kind of a tension in the air now, in that the impression I seem to be getting is that there are things that could accelerate Boris Johnson's demise as much as there are things that can put it off or delay it. If Prime Minister's question this week were to be a very poor performance, there are MPs that could put it out. The fact that we're even discussing letters going into the 1922 committee is a scary thing. I remember when we were covering Theresa May's premiership, when she lost the 2017 election, Nick Timothy, it was the advisers that were cleared out. But normally it's the advisers who get the blame for the Premier's mistakes, whether they are rightfully the Premier's mistakes or not. Dominic Cummings has already gone from Johnson's government. How far can he get away with blaming his staff for these mistakes? How far will the buck finally stop with him? It's an open question. In many ways, like, Sue Gray may just be the first step of a longer running sort of casting of blame.
Thanks, James. Yeah, minions' heads will roll. Bloomberg's James Woolcock there with the latest gossip from Westminster.
Well, let's switch focus now, because in 3 weeks' time, the energy regulator Ofgem will announce the new energy price cap, which will take effect from April. Soaring wholesale gas prices over the winter mean that households could see their energy bills jump 50 or even 60%. Let's discuss this now with Mika Minio-Paluello, who is energy analyst and the policy lead for climate and industry at the TUC, the Trades Union Congress. Mika, welcome to the programme. Thank you so much for being with us. A lot has been flagged in terms of energy bills going up. It hasn't hit households yet, although inflation is already up. The government can't really do anything to mitigate the rise in global energy prices, though, can it?
Thanks for having me on. I think it can. I mean, you're right that we've got a big problem here about the dependence on global prices and effectively a globally traded commodity. But ultimately, we also face a lot of the systemic problems we're facing are because of the way our energy market in the UK works. And ultimately, it is bust, it is broken. The market here has failed to deliver affordable or secure energy. We've had a decade of calling for more competition within the energy supply market, which is why we went from, you know, having a small number of energy suppliers to more than 70. And there was a lot of pressure on consumers to switch and switch and switch, which ultimately many of those companies have now gone bust. And there's a cost of living crisis facing millions and millions across the country. Mm. And I think we need to learn the lessons that actually that just saying we need more companies in a mix and people should switch, that wasn't actually fixing the problem.
Wasn't competition working fairly well before the price got out of control? You said there were 70 companies, so clearly there was a lot of competition. Were you unhappy with the way it was working?
I think it depends about what we mean working well. Were there many companies involved? Yes. Was it working well for households? Not necessarily. I mean, the reality is that many people were still paying much too much. And ultimately, energy supply, we all know that energy supply, that's not where generation happens, that's not where electricity moves. It's largely a paper market. Like, it's people just that when you buy your electricity from whoever, OVO, that OVO is not generating, it doesn't lead to investment in infrastructure. And ultimately, infrastructure generation, where the electricity or the gas comes from, is what determines down the line the prices. And our energy infrastructure in the UK has been hollowed out over this period of time. We've had, not just last decade, decades, particularly since privatization, that, you know, gas storage, less of that, Rough was closed, the Rough storage site, energy storage, we've got issues. Networks haven't had the investment to accelerate the net zero transition that we need to see. Domestic manufacturing for renewables, yes, and the renewables, yes, rollout, nuclear, all of those have been hollowed out over time. And
okay,
that,
but
that
hang on,
leaves
go,
us
go,
more susceptible. Yep,
more,
yep,
susceptible, yes. Okay, so understood. But on the issue of the price cap, that has actually functioned incredibly well for consumers. It has kept prices in check for a decade.
Yeah.
And that is actually a pretty amazing sort of result. Also, the UK is very different to Europe, for example, which is highly dependent on Russia for natural gas now and is in perhaps arguably an even worse state than the UK, which only relies on Russia for 1% of its energy needs. So comparatively, we've done better.
We haven't had the price cap for a decade. The price cap came in after Ed Miliband spoke about doing it and then was derided heavily in the media, and then afterwards it came in. So we haven't had it quite that long. But yes, the price cap was positive in terms of making sure that those people on standard variable tariffs weren't ripped off to the extent that they had been before. But it was a limited, benefit, and we see the limitations of it now when those underlying factors of massively soaring gas prices hit us. And you're right that there's different levels of dependency in different countries, but I don't have the precise breakdown for which countries are paying how much more. My understanding is actually bills are going up more in the UK than a lot of other EU countries, and particularly also our manufacturing industries are struggling more. And there's a range of factors. Sometimes that's about how much gas storage there is in the mix. Mm. Sometimes that's about how much heating is provided by gas versus electricity. Like, the UK is quite, because of our high dependence on gas for heating homes rather than district heating, let's say, or accelerating the shift to electrification, we're very dependent on that. And yes, we don't get much gas from Russia coming into the UK, but ultimately, as you pointed out, it's a globally traded commodity. So whether the gas is coming from the North Sea or we're getting an LNG arrival from Algeria or from Qatar, it's still very expensive. So that cost still comes through into the system.
Yeah, so where do we go from here? Energy bills are rising right across the continent. It does vary. You're right. In some countries, it's more than others, but they are rising rapidly pretty much everywhere in Europe. What do we do in the short term? I appreciate there are things we can do over the next 10 years to make the market work better, but how do we sort out this big problem which is coming very rapidly down the line?
Yeah, so I think it's crucial that we basically do both alongside the kind of immediate term and the medium term. I don't think we should wait 10 years to do any of these things. I think there's very, very immediate term measures that need to be brought in to protect low-income households. So whether that's around expanding the warm homes discount to cover, to be larger, but also to cover more households. Increasing it by £50 doesn't make much difference if your bill goes up by £600. The change needs to be, the support needs to be commensurate. But also at the moment, the warm homes discount doesn't reach nearly enough people. It should be expanded to, for instance, everybody who receives universal credit, particularly those homes that are the most vulnerable, or pensions credit. So we need those emergency measures to reach people. But alongside that, we also need to be bringing in the kind of structural change right now that can protect people. So an obvious example would be a mass home insulation program. You know, we had the Green Homes Grant program, yeah, but that failed, was clearly badly implemented. There's important lessons to learn from them. There was actually a subpart of the Green Homes Grant program which was delivered through local authorities, which actually worked quite well, and the government has recognised that and given some increased funding to that bit. But that should be expanded significantly and rolled out rapidly, delivered by local councils in-house, and that obviously changes the underlying conditions that people then need less energy to heat their homes. Their homes are automatically warmer.
But in a sense, Micah, you're asking for essentially tax rises, because all of this would need to be funded, and tax rises is one of the other things that is squeezing households so badly. Expanding the warm homes discount would be enormously costly.
It's expensive. I think tax rises obviously depend on who the tax is on, for a start. So I think a tax rise by default, like let's say, doesn't impact everybody, particularly doesn't necessarily impact low-income households. The obvious example that is being floated widely, government is exploring it, Lib Dems, the Labour, have put out proposals for a range of different windfall taxes on North Sea oil and gas companies, particularly on those companies that are making extremely large profits off the back of the gas price crisis. And I think it's an important question to ask of those households, all of us that pay bills, and particularly those households that are struggling the most, should they be effectively paying hundreds of pounds each towards greater profits on behalf of Shell, BP, Exxon, as well as, Putin, Qatar, etc.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.